Greetings. Sleepy Salsa here on this Saturday, April 28th of 2012, and welcome to the 51st episode of the Last Bastille podcast. This broadcast is kindly hosted over at youhavetreadonme.com. I should also take this opportunity to mention that the opening theme is Ashley Alisize's A Puzzling Predicament, and the outro will be Bosa's King's Quest, both of them available pursuant to Creative Commons Attribution, specifically CC BY NC SA 3.0 unported. For more information on Creative Commons, visit them at creativecommons.org. For any other content that may not be of original authorship by yours truly, any such material is used under the sincere intention of fair use. If you wish to understand the nature of the situation we are all suffering under and what can be done about it, feel free to visit The Last Bastille blog, which is located over at The Last Bastille. Bastille is spelled B-A-S-T-I-L-L-E, thelastbastille.wordpress.com. The blog is also now available in Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure Socket Layer, known by the more common acronym of HTTPS. The listener chat room, located primarily at yhtom.chatango.com, as well as on youhavetreadonme.com/radio_show.html, will be available tonight for the benefit of the audience. This episode, we are going to focus on monarchism. Nations throughout history have always had some kind of leadership. People also want to have their champion, their singular figurehead that they can admire. Monarchy, as a system of government, has existed for thousands of years. Historically, the mechanisms of liberty have been understood against the backdrop of kingdoms. While other forms of the state come and go, monarchy always retains certain qualities that has endeared it to the human psyche, perpetuating itself, even if only through fiction. Our guest tonight is John Allen Martinson Jr. He is a vlogger, podcaster, and publisher of the Martinson edition of Freemasonry and Judaism, The Secret Powers Behind Revolution, by Vicomte Leon de Ponsens. He is also the director, co-producer, and chief narrator of a two-hour documentary entitled Missing Links, which details how Israel was responsible for the mass murder of September 11, 2001. He is also the chairman of the Monarchist Party. It is a legally registered party whose aim is to abolish the federal constitution. Tonight, we're going to examine the basics of monarchy and why it should be implemented in the United States. With that said, let us turn to our guest. John, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you for the introduction. And thank you for having me.
And we definitely appreciate having you on tonight, sir. So, John, when did you first begin to see through the fog?
Well, I think from my earliest memory, I had this overwhelming feeling that something was wrong in the world, but it wasn't until much later in my life that I started to pin down exactly what that was. If we go back to some of my writings in my teen years, we can see that I was almost there, but I still just couldn't pin it down. There was a gentleman that I met, this was during Ron Paul's campaign for president, not this recent one here, but the one before that, that I met a guy who approached me and said, as I was talking about, the Illuminati and the criminals and this, that, and the other thing, he said, well, you know, they have their own religion. And that just sparked my interest. So I met with him and had some conversations with him, and he really showed me a lot about what was going on, and I sort of took my research from there. So it's been over the past few years where I've blazed a trail through, you know, all the different conspiracy theories and things which are out there, and you know, really come to the perspective that I have today.
All right, so John, what is monarchism?
Monarchism is the rule of a single individual over a nation, as opposed to a republic. Of course, a republic is the rule of a group of people over a nation, and those people have been democratically elected to their office. A monarch, of course, could be initially democratically elected, but after that, to be a true monarchy, which is absolute monarchy, meaning that the monarch has complete and total authority over the nation, the monarch's successor would be chosen by him or her. So when we talk about absolute rule of the nation, this comes down to everything. The monarch has the monarch is the state, as Napoleon put it. He is the head of all corporations. He's the head of the media. He is, of course, the commander-in-chief of the military. He pretty much controls everything. Well, he does control everything within the nation, as opposed to a republic where if a decision needs to be made, if we're going to direct the state in a particular direction, there's a voting process and so on. None of that takes place in a monarchy. The monarch simply says, this is what we're going to do, and then that's what happens.
Now, historically, how have nation states transitioned from mostly monarchies to being mostly a combination of democracies and republics?
Well, people imagine that we've evolved into democracy, and we must be clear that a republic is a democracy. You know, as of late, there's been a lot of people that say, well, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. I'm sorry, a republic is a democracy. You are democratically electing your representatives. There's a democratic process there. So the term democracy applies to a republic, unless you elect the people in your republic, they take their office a different way. So people didn't suddenly collectively decide one day, you know, a piece of paper with some rules on it would be a better way to ensure our liberty. Or, you know, I think a group of politicians deciding on the direction of state is better than a king or queen. It simply didn't happen that way. Now, we can go as far back in history as ancient Egypt, which its true name is Kemet, K-E-M-E-T, if we were to spell it in English. Something that people are most familiar with, especially with, you know, the name of your particular podcast, The Last Bastille, would be the French Revolution. Now, what I would really like all the listeners to do to really get a clear picture of what took place during the French Revolution is simply just to go to Google Images and type in the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And we look on that document, and at the top of that document, we find the all-seeing eye of the Bavarian Illuminati, which is the highest office of Freemasonry, staring right back at you. Okay, so we can tell just visually, for those in the know, we can see who is behind the French Revolution. So Freemasonry and the what I call the Jewish power elite, or the Jewish crime network, really they are the ones that are responsible for the overturning of monarchies throughout the world. And there's a very special reason for this, and that is because when it comes to a, quote, dictator, and I personally don't have a problem with dictator. He's one who dictates. A monarch is a, quote, dictator. Now, we could say that if we use the term dictator, we're really meaning the negatives. And even monarchs will say, oh, you know, we don't want a dictator, we want a monarch. But I don't have a problem with the particular term. Anyway, basically what I'm saying when we're talking about a dictator is whether we're saying a monarch with absolute authority or we are talking about someone else who is sort of serving as a quasi-monarch. The criminal factions out there have a serious problem with this because all it takes is for this guy to wave his hand and say, you are expelled from my country. Okay, so if you go to, folks can Google Freemasonry expelled. You know, how many countries has Freemasonry been expelled, and who expelled them? You know, was it a republic that was expelling them, or was it a, quote, dictator or quasi-monarch or an actual full-blown monarch, what have you? You can also go to Google and you can type in Jews expelled. Now, the Jewish subject takes that, – that's a touchy subject, number one, and it takes a while to really talk about. But I think that a lot of people are aware of Zionism, and if you're more comfortable with that term, then go ahead and use that. I particularly don't use that term because the Jewish power elite have been a problem well before Zionism was ever codified. So when I'm talking about Jews, I'm talking about criminal Jews, and I have no problem to say use that term. Anyway, so we find that this overturning of monarchy happened by their hand. And just to go through just a few monarchs in a few countries will give you a better sense of what happened. And I implore everybody to read the book Freemasonry and Judaism by Viscount Léon de Ponsens, who was a French noble of the House of Montaigne. Now, in France, His Majesty, King of France, Louis XVI, was executed by guillotine by Judeo-Freemasonic revolutionaries, and that was on January 21st, 1793. He was 38 years old. Her Majesty, the Queen of France, Marie Antoinette, was executed by guillotine by Judeo-Freemasonic revolutionaries, on October 16th, 1793, at the age of 37. Now, upon the execution of his father, His Royal Highness, that would be Louis XVII, became heir to the throne of France. However, imprisoned at the age of 7, Prince Royal of France, Louis XVII, would never rule. The young boy was treated cruelly in the confines of a cold and damp prison cell, and finally, becoming ill with tuberculosis, died at the age of 10 on June 8, 1795. He was buried in the cemetery of Sainte Marguerite, but no stone was erected to mark the little one's final resting place. Okay, what we have here is the overthrow of a monarchy. We have the Judeo-Freemasonic forces that have done this, and our visual proof is right there in the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And there is much more proof that I'm not going to get into. The book is available for you. You can even, if you don't have the money, you know, you can go to the Pirate Bay or whatever other place, and you can find a copy of the English translation, not my version of it, but you can find the English translation. My version of it adds a lot more to the book in terms of pictures, and I've translated all the French and German and other languages that appear throughout. We moved to Portugal, and His Majesty King Carlos I, who lived 1889 to 1908, was assassinated by Freemasonic Republican conspirators while riding in an open carriage with his family bound for the royal palace. His 20-year-old son, heir to the throne, Prince Royal of Portugal, Luis Felipe, was mortally wounded and died shortly after. So once again, this is not a situation where people are going, oh, you know what, I think that a constitution, a republic would just be a better thing for us. These are blatant coups that have taken place by the Jewish power elite and Freemasonry being the servant of the Jewish power elite. Of course, that should be obvious considering the Star of David is a key symbol of Freemasonry. We look to Spain, His Majesty the beloved Alfonso XIII, who lived from 1886 to 1941. He was the King of Spain. He faced numerous assassination attempts, including on his wedding day. Under the pressures of Freemasonic revolutionary energies, the king was formerly loved by all. He had kept his people out of the bloody First World War. So that's another subject, but people concern themselves, well, are we just, if we had a monarch, are we just going to be going to war all the time, and is it going to be the sort of imperialistic, colonialistic kind of thing that's happening? We have a beautiful example with His Majesty of Spain. He was forced into exile in 1931, and he passed away just 10 years later at the young age of 54. We go to Turkey. His Imperial Majesty, the Sultan Abdulhamid II, Emperor of the Ottomans, Caliph of the Faithful. He lived from 1842 to 1918. He was ousted by Jewish Freemasonic forces in 1909. His Imperial Majesty passed away in captive exile 9 years later. Heartbroken, certainly. We moved to Hungary. The lovely Archduchess Sophie von Hohenberg. This was 1868. She lived from 1868 to 1914. She was assassinated on June 28, 1914. Her husband, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, died not long after being shot in the throat. As his wife lay dying in his lap from a gunshot wound to the stomach, the Archduke begged of her, "Sophie, dear, don't die. Stay alive for our children." Now, these are the nobles who have dedicated their entire life, their breath, their pulse, their children, their entire family line is dedicated to you, and assassinated, abdicated, left and right. We move to Germany. The mighty Emperor of Germany, Wilhelm II, who lived from 1859 to 1900, he fell to the Jewish engineered German Revolution of 1918 and 1919. The Kaiser or Emperor was forced to abdicate and flee into exile. He later spoke of the necessity to deal with the Jewish nemesis that had misled his people against him. So again, we have this king, or in his case, an emperor, who is very familiar with these Jewish forces, and we might think that, oh, it was just Hitler came along, and he had this crazy idea that Jews were a problem and whatever, but this is a pretty well-known thing in the circles of monarchy. And in the circles of quote dictators, if you will, we can look to Idi Amin of Uganda, and supposedly he was a big evil mass murderer, whatever, and that's propaganda. But he, of course, expelled the Jews from Uganda, and he was the last to do so. Of course, I'm told that the Jews are not allowed in. Well, let me back up. The Jews were also expelled from Libya, which, of course, is why they just killed the leader of Libya, Gaddafi, and the Jews are also, to my knowledge, not allowed in North Korea. But anyway, what we can see here, and if you read Viscount de Ponson's work, we find this very careful process of overthrowing monarchies. Again, this did not happen overnight. This was not some evolution. Okay, we are actually digressing. We are de-evolving as we take on the infantile concept of republics or constitutions. So that was a long-winded answer, but I hope I've addressed that pretty well.
Wow, there is so much material there. That would definitely bear further investigation, especially for another episode, absolutely. So, you know, John, what is the illusion of law? Is there a you know, we hear a lot of times in the patriot community about, you know, my rights and, you know, liberties or what have you. Is there also a difference between rights and liberties?
There's definitely a difference between rights and liberties, and what we have here are a lot of terms which are intended as, these are emotional trigger words. These are propaganda words that you can use to manipulate a society. I mean, everybody loves the idea of freedom, and everybody loves the idea of rights. Oh, I have rights. I've got freedom. But if we really examine what these terms really mean, we find that they just fall flat. It's all thin air. Okay, a right is a guarantee. There are no guarantees in life. Therefore, there is no such thing as a right. It does not exist. It's never existed. There is no such thing as a right. You do not have rights from anyone or anything. For instance, people talk about God-given rights. They say, well, I've got a God-given right to this. Well, first of all, I haven't had a personal conversation with God where he's come down and said, hey, you have this particular right, and I don't know anybody saying that actually has. But if there are these God-given rights, then I'm not an atheist, so let's be clear on that. But in terms of a God-given right, children do not have a right to love, shelter, to be born with lungs that work, eyes that work, ears that work, to be born in a nation that is not in complete and total abject poverty. There are no rights. So then we are supposed to believe that there is a document which has granted you a right, for instance, the right to keep and bear arms. If that is a right, then it is a guarantee. It is something that cannot be taken away from you. Okay, so as soon as somebody comes and takes, Mr. Gun Rights guy, takes his firearm away, so, well, I have a right to this. Well, no, if you had a right, it couldn't be taken away from you. It is a guarantee. So the concept is, and, you could take rights and liberties and you can interchange them simply for the simplicity of language and because we're used to these terms. But what we really need to do, in my opinion, is become a little more clear in what we're talking about here. And we're talking about liberties. The Constitution gives you liberties. A liberty is not a guarantee. It is something which is typically granted by a power and which can be taken away by the same power. So, for instance, in the United States Navy, let's imagine you're a sailor and you have weekend liberty. This is something that the power is granting you, and they can also just deny it to you at any time. And knowing that it is liberty, it's, quote, something nice that's being done for you by this great power, you always know that it can be taken away. Liberties are equivalent to the sword of Damocles. And if you're not familiar with the sword of Damocles, if there's any listeners out there, basically it amounts to this. Damocles wanted to switch places with Dionysius. Dionysius was this great ruler, and he had all these riches, and he was eating well all the time, and he has lavish clothing, and and all the pageantry that comes with being a monarch. So Dionysius says, okay, sure, you can switch places with me. And as Damocles sits on the throne, he looks up and notices that there is a sword hanging above his head, and it's hanging by a horsehair. So at any point in time, this thing could snap, and of course he would be dead. So finally Damocles says, you know what, Dionysius, I'm just not interested in this anymore. You can have the throne back. And really, the sword of Damocles, every monarch has the sword of Damocles hanging over his head, every absolute monarch, because we always know who is absolutely responsible. It's as simple as that. In a republic, you don't know who's responsible. Who exactly is it? And we can get into that because it's a comedy, really, when we start to try to figure out exactly who's responsible. But see, the people, they don't want to come face to face with this liberty concept. No, I have rights. I have rights. No, you don't. You have liberties. Once you realize you have a liberty, then you also know that you have the sword of Damocles hanging over that liberty. Okay? And we need to be mature enough and have the courage to say, you know what, I'm quite fine with that. I have a liberty to have firearms, and of course they can take it away at any point in time. And if we acknowledge that something can be taken away at any point in time, instead of living in this mystical, magical headspace where a piece of paper is guaranteeing something when we know that there's no guarantees in life, then we're going to have a much better picture of what must be done in order to secure our liberties, okay?
Wow, that's quite powerful. I never quite thought of it that way before. Now, would it be accurate to say, John, that humans are naturally monarchistic by nature?
Yes, I think so. And I think that when we look at a republic and we look at a constitution, these things are completely alien to Earth. They are not earthling. When we look at the animal kingdom, when we look at insects, you find monarchy throughout Earth, throughout these kingdoms, okay? But suddenly, man is going, well, I could do better. I'll do a republic, and I'll have this constitution, and we'll do it this way and that way, and whatever the case might be. And to me, that completely opposes what it is, what we're supposed to be doing here on Earth and as human beings. You know, monarchy is the long, not only the longest lasting form of government, but it is the oldest form of government. People have this misconception, for instance, oh, well, there were the Native Americans and there were the Africans, and you know, and there's some pretty old people here and there, and they lived in a sort of communal type situation and whatever. And really, that's just propaganda, that's misinformation. Some of them did have a sort of communitarianism, which today we would call communism. Some of them had sort of a republic-type system and so on. But the thing that you find in majority is monarchy. The only reason, and folks need to really wrap their head around this, there is no chief what's-his-name or, you know, chief this guy, you know, Joe Blow or whatever the case is. The only reason why they were called chief was to demean them. They were kings and emperors, and many of them had royal succession through. So if you want to go and demean someone, you could go over to his land and call him a savage, and you'd take a look at his leader. And even though the leader happens to control more land than the own colonialist bastard nation that you came from, you call him chief. But no. It's Emperor Shaka Zulu. It's King Seattle, and so on. You know, we have this calling towards monarchy, and all children have this calling towards monarchy and this comfort with it, this fascination. There's a magic there. You know, little girls do not, you know, dream of being a congressman or congresswoman, whichever. Okay, they're not saying, you know, I want to pretend that I'm a congresswoman. Right? they want to be princesses. Okay, and when they're grown women, they don't wait with bated breath for a senator to come riding in on a white horse in shining armor. They're waiting for a knight. Okay, so these concepts are in us, and there's a magic in us that's been taken away by this dead thing, completely lifeless thing called the Constitution. There's no life in it. It can't protect anybody from anything because it's a piece of paper in a box. That's what it is, as opposed to a living, breathing human being. Okay, so again, there's an alien thing here. There's a dead thing. And of course, you know, little boys, they dream of being knights and so on and what have you. And, you know, we can just, you know, see how we're called to these things in fiction, which, you know, we can talk about later. But there's a thing that that one guy had said to me as we were talking about monarchy, and he himself being a monarchist said, you know, the thing about having a king is it really lets you express and realize your own inner king. You know, you can't express and realize your own inner king when you have a president. You know, the president is not a king. This guy comes and goes. You know, he's changed, you know, every few years. You can't be the king. You know, people say, well, my home is my castle. And of course, you know, the man is head of household. Well, you are the king of that household. Well, how are you supposed to be the king of your house in this ridiculously feminist society, in this backwards constitutional democratically elected republic? It's not going to happen. You know, you need to be able as a man and as a woman as well, and even as children, to project your own inner monarch onto the monarch that is the leader of your nation. You can live up to these people. These people can be examples of your greatness, of who you can be, rather. So we look at Her Royal Highness Diana, Princess of Wales, okay? And while some of the blood of money changers may have been in her veins, she was honorable. She was an outstanding human being. And our little girls, would you rather have our little girls looking up to someone like Princess Diana? Or would you rather have them look up to Britney Spears or look up to Supreme Court Justice, what's her name, that's nothing but a criminal, or, you know, however many other criminal politicians and judiciary that we want to talk about in this backwards republic? There's something very special about, there's something very human, and there's a rightness to monarchy that you simply don't get with these ridiculously overcomplex systems, you know, the republic, communism, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, you know, John, several of our, you know, listeners are concerned with certain, you know, groups of bad guys of one flavor or another that gather together in secret and plan and plot things. And then those, you know, plans are implemented through their various different criminal organizations and what have you, such, you know, including but not limited to something like the Bilderberg Group. And it is noted that, for example, in the Bilderberg Group attendee list, you will have certain monarchs like Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands and other similar people like that. So I think it would be fair to ask, is monarchism opposed to globalism? And then similarly, is monarchy patriotic?
Okay, you can't say that monarchism is opposed to globalism because the monarch can do as he wishes. If he wants to make an attempt to conquer the world, then he has the ability to do so, notwithstanding his people rising up against him and cutting off his head. So that simply cannot be said. Now, are there monarchs that, for whatever reason, support the New World Order? And when we're talking about the New World Order, I mean, here's the thing. The New World Order, in our minds, is a very specific Freemasonic Illuminist structure, okay? But it doesn't have to take that form. Anyway, if a monarch is in support of this conception of the New World Order, well, that's on him. And why – we have to ask ourselves, why is he doing that? Who is behind his throne? You know, most monarchs wouldn't involve themselves with the, you know, Jewish power elite, the money changers, the money lenders, the banksters, whatever you want to call them, unless somehow they got suckered or didn't have the brains, what have you, to lend, to borrow money, rather, from them. They get into this borrowing money, they get into situations where their power is being threatened, and as a monarch, well, frankly, what are you going to do, okay? Especially in this world where there are so few surviving monarchs, especially so few absolute monarchs. There's a lot of conspiracy garbage about the, you know, the Queen of England, okay? And she's a lizard, right? And she's involved with, I don't know, space aliens and whatever else. But the thing with her and the thing with that monarchy is that a long time ago, they installed Parliament, okay? And the Rothschilds came in. And this is her fault, okay? This is the fault, rather, of the British monarchs, okay? But we have to really look at what's going on. The British monarchy does not have the power it once had. The true power of the monarchy rests in those who control her bank account. Okay? So for us to say, oh, well, monarchy must be bad because look at what the British monarchy is doing or has done. Well, hold on a minute. We have to look at who the puppet masters are. You know, thankfully, we have a lot of information out there that's at our fingertips. So for monarchs today and any future monarchs or nobles that come into power, they have the ability to look back and, you know, see the mistakes that have been made by other monarchs. You know, namely, as I mentioned, you know, the Jewish expulsions. The Jews have been expelled from 109 countries, or rather, they've been expelled 109 times from 84 different countries. They've been expelled from every nation in Europe. Okay, and if we go back to ancient Egypt, they were also expelled from ancient Egypt when they were known as the Hyksos. So that really makes it 85 countries. But, you know, if a monarch can't learn from that, and if a monarch, you know, is borrowing money from the money changers, or he allows Freemasonry or other secret societies to exist in his realm, that's really his fault. Now, in terms of being opposed to globalism, what have you, you know, the real issue that people have is who is, you know, a new world order, quote, or a nation of Earth, rather. The thing that people have a problem with, I think, is who is going to run the show. I mean, if you gave people a survey and said, well, if there was going to be an emperor of Earth, would you be okay if Aragorn from The Lord of the Rings ran the show? I think most people are like, no, Aragorn's great, man. He's a great guy. You know, granted, he's fiction, but, you know, Christians are all monarchists. Whether they admit it or not, whether they understand it or not, you know, Christ is the King of Kings. It's not like he's coming back to, you know, just, you know, lead Zimbabwe. He's coming back, in the view of Christians, to rule over the entire earth. And guess what? That is a new world order. It's just not the new world order that the conspiracy theorists and so forth and what we're familiar with in the Patriot movement. So would a monarch pursue globalism? I particularly wouldn't, as, you know, if I were a monarch. But again, that's we can't say that monarchy is specifically opposed to globalism, but we can say that a nationalist monarch, a monarch that isn't bought and paid for, a monarch with some common sense, is definitely, positively going to be opposed to the New World Order. What absolute monarch that hasn't already been bought, you know, and paid for, or what have you, what monarch in his right mind is going to let the United Nations have any bloody say-so in his nation?
Wow, okay. Well, what would be the relationship between the monarch and the citizenry?
Okay, well, the monarch is the embodiment of the nation. He is a symbol of all the people that exist within that nation, and the power of the nation, and so on. So in what way are you talking about the relationship, you know, between the citizenry and the monarch?
Well, for instance, I mean, wouldn't it be true that the citizens would just be subjects instead of having liberties? Or I'm trying to think of a way how to phrase it, because it's kind of a concern that a lot of different other political dissidents would have about monarchy, that it's this, you know, dictatorial, hegemonic thing that's going to be tyrannical. So I wanted to kind of ask what would be the relationship between the monarch, basically that the state, since the monarch is the state, and the citizenry, and kind of seeing if there's any way of having liberty, if the citizenry under a monarchy having liberty.
Okay, the citizens have as much liberty as the monarch allows. And that liberty remains so long as the citizenry is willing to fight for that liberty should the monarch take it away. So it's a very mature thing. It's a very adult thing. No one is making you any ridiculous promises that, you know, some words written down on some paper are guaranteeing you a bloody thing. They're not guaranteeing you anything. The monarch is the servant of the people, and the people are in service to him. So one of the things that I often say is this concept of serve and be served. And that's what it really is. You know, can the monarch take things away from them? Yeah, at any point in time. Are the citizens expected to serve the monarch? Absolutely, you know, because through serving the monarch, they are serving the nation until such a time that the monarch is clearly not in service to the people, to what the nation is intended to embody or exemplify.
Now, would it be accurate to say that regicide be considered a kind of check and balance against the crown?
Absolutely. You know, this check and balance thing, you know, people say, well, what kind of checks and balances are we going to have? We need checks and balances. What are you talking about? If you're not talking about hot lead coming out of the barrel of a rifle, then you're not talking checks and balances. You're talking fiction. And I don't involve myself in fiction. I don't involve myself in ideas that, you know, written words can protect anybody from anything. I involve myself in hot lead and steel and things which are physical. Okay, if you are in a room with a mass murderer, there is nothing that you can write down on a piece of paper that is going to stop him from killing you if he is intent on doing so. But hot lead will. Okay, so the check and balance against the crown is the firearm. Absolutely. So regicide is always on the table. You know, if the monarch gets out of hand, then, you know, you either need to put the pressure on him to let him know, hey, look, you're going to have to step down. You know, let's go with your successor. And if your successor's a cretin, then, you know, go with somebody else, whatever the case might be. But we're not going to tolerate you. And if he's like, oh, well, I'm not going to step down, then quite frankly, to put it bluntly, then you blow his brains out. And that's a very mature thing. That's a thing that's a very adult thing that people, you know, a lot of people aren't comfortable with because they have been hypnotized into this idea that the idea of rights, that you have guarantees. There are no guarantees. Anybody that's trying to sell you a guarantee is lying to you. There's not even guarantees when they advertise them on television and say, we're giving you a 30-day whatever guarantee. What happens when the corporation collapses the next day? Who's going to guarantee you? Who's going to give you your money back, you know, for the gym equipment or whatever the crap that you bought? Not going to happen. There are no guarantees. It's just really a maturing that people need to be comfortable with. And that's very difficult in this society because people are so hypnotized that, oh, well, maybe if we can just return to the Constitution. What do you mean? Return to what? The Constitution exists. The Constitution is in place. But we need to be living under the laws of the Constitution. The Constitution couldn't protect itself. It can't. It's a piece of paper. It's sitting in a box somewhere. It cannot jump out of the box and say, great, you've returned to the Constitution, and now you're going against it again for the third time. I'm tired of this. Ba-da-da-da. The Constitution cannot speak. It cannot walk. It cannot defend anybody from anything. It is a piece of paper.
So, John, if I think we're hearing you right, you're telling us that a document that has information on it can't guarantee us anything.
Absolutely. That's exactly it.
Well, definitely food for thought at the very least. All right. Well, you know, you were mentioning before about how top down I think it would be accurate to say that a monarchy is, and you know, gauging from what I've said with people in private, especially in private conversations, whenever the topic of monarchy came up, it was interesting. You know, generally speaking, if somebody had been in the military, they were much more receptive to that, whereas people who never were, or shall we say civilians, were a lot more recalcitrant about it, or otherwise very dismissive of it, making jokes about it, that sort of thing. So, John, why are people so scared of totalitarianism?
Well, this is a maturity thing, because, I mean, honestly, everybody would be much more comfortable in their seats if I was saying, you know what, we need to return to the Constitution, and this is going to give our liberty, you know, we're going to get our freedoms and liberties and rights and all this other stuff. We're going to have this thing, and we can vote. We can just go and do this peaceful process and whatever the case is, and we can write our congressmen, because there's no threat to your life in that situation. But that's not, very nonsense. It doesn't, no. Okay, that's mysticism. It's an illusion. Okay, when you're dealing with criminals, if a criminal is intent on doing something, the only way to stop him is to arrest him, expel him. Basically, let's just sum it up this way, because there's a lot of things you can do with a criminal, but they all involve the use of force. Whether you're talking about the force to grab his arms and put him behind his back and put handcuffs on them, or whether you're talking about the force to pull a trigger, or whatever, the force to manhandle him and throw him into a prison, or to, you know, grab him and stick a noose around his neck. It's force. And people are very uncomfortable with that reality, and you know, we can talk about whatever they're putting in the drinking water and everything else, but in this society, there's a feminization of men that's happening, a demasculinization of men, and we're just not really comfortable with that stuff anymore. We've gotten so comfortable with the hypnosis. Let me think about this, guys. Back Revolutionary War. What triggered the Revolutionary War? You know, it started with this tax thing. Oh, they're taxing us, and you know, that it's so horrible. You know, this is the event that kicks off the Revolutionary War, and today we pay more taxes than, you know, we were paying back then, all right? And men, they weren't going to stand for it. Forget about it. You know what we got to do? We got to grab our muskets, let's rock and roll, okay? In this situation, no. People, you know, they have a problem with this total rule thing, because they must face the reality that they may have to fight, but you may not have to fight. But it's that maybe you do that people are uncomfortable with. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. You know, what's so big about a monarch? You know, totalitarianism. The monarch can do all kinds of great things in this having absolute authority. You know, think about some things in this society which are just ridiculous. I've mentioned this to you before, in our conversations, where, you know, these revolutions have grown out of pubs, taverns, and so forth, okay? And today, your local bar is a place for – it's an extension of your living room. It is a place for you to go plug in and get mind wiped, as opposed to having a conversation with men that are willing to fight, that are going to have a conversation about what needs to be done in their local neighborhood. It is a place for you to go and plug into a television screen. It is a place for you to get wasted and go and mindlessly look at whatever game or propaganda news, whatever happens to be there. So what if we had a monarch that says, you know what, you're not going to have any televisions in bars except those that are specifically rated as a – or billed whatever as a sports bar. oh, that's totalitarianism, you know, for him to have that sweeping move. But, I mean, look, you live, people understand, you're living in a totalitarian situation right now, but they can't identify the criminals. I mean, they've already banned smoking out of the bars in most of the states in the United States. Doesn't that sound a little totalitarian? Or how about one of the other keywords? You're like, oh, it's fascist. Ooh, okay. But you can't even identify who the, you know, who is really responsible for this. Was it Obama? Really? Was it Obama? Was it Bush? Was it Congress? Was it the Bilderbergs? How about the Freemasons? Are you hip to the Zionists, the neocons? Was it your neighbor? Now think about that. Was it your neighbor? Because in democracy, your neighbor is always potentially your enemy. You know, that's, you know, a republic, a democratically elected republic, or any other form of democracy. It's always pitting you against your neighbor, always, you know. So it's a very divisive thing. Instead of "we the people" written across the top of the Constitution, they need to write "divided we fall," because that's exactly what they've done with their little democracy. So totalitarianism, I have no problem with it, with absolutist monarchy, with this guy having complete total control, because I can identify exactly who is responsible. If there is too much litter on the street, I know exactly who is responsible. There's a chain of command, sure. There's Baron What's-His-Face, there's Viscount What's-Her-Name, and Count So-and-So, and then we go up to Duke What's-His-Face, and then finally we get to Mr. King. Mr. King, how come you haven't solved this issue? You have the absolute power to do it. How come we are still putting our men and women, we're taking them overseas and they're getting killed for a war for Israel? But who's responsible for that? You can't tell me who's responsible. You can't tell me Obama's responsible. You can't even tell me Bush is responsible, because you really don't know all the players. Matter of fact, if we were going to round up all these criminals and we needed to create a list of the criminals that are actually responsible, from the corporate CEOs that are making all their money, the Halliburton, this, that, and the other thing, the Blackwater mercenaries, the Bilderbergers, the Freemasons, the Bavarian Illuminati, the da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's going to take you days, if not months, to write all the names down. But you know what? I'm quite comfortable with my totalitarian absolute monarchy, because I know that if our troops aren't pulled out of there and we have a monarch, I know exactly who's responsible. I know exactly who needs to be taken off the throne. You don't. You live in a republic. Your neighbor is your enemy. You don't know how many of your neighbors voted to keep What's-His-Face in power. How many of your neighbors support the war? How many of your neighbors are Freemasons or this, that, or the other thing? You have no idea. Months and months of you writing names down versus one man or woman that is responsible. So it's a maturity thing. It is a come face to face with this reality. You may actually have to risk your life to secure your liberty. That's why people have a problem with totalitarianism.
Wow, very powerful perspective, and definitely something to be considered by the listening audience at the very least. Now, John, would it be accurate to say that a monarch is the only true diplomat?
Yes, absolutely. An absolute monarch who controls his own money is definitely going to be your true diplomat, because, well, first of all, he doesn't serve a term, okay? He's not there for 4 years and a maximum 8 years. He is there for his entire life. He owns the wealth of the land. He literally owns everything except that which, of course, you own yourself, which is whatever you have created or purchased or whatever the case is. But the land that your house sits on, he owns that. The house, no, you own that, OK? okay. The currency that's being printed, that's his, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to imagine this man's wealth. Now, the top paid CEO, according to Forbes, was making something like $130 million a year. All right. Is it possible that you could bribe a monarch with $130 million a year? Not a chance. Is it possible that you could bribe a monarch with a salary of $100 billion a year? Yeah, as soon as you're done with your term, we're going to put you on our board of directors and you're going to have $100 billion salary. I don't think so. The monarch is worth a heck of a lot more than that. And he has absolute power. Would you really want to give that up? You see, you have these presidents that must pander to certain groups because they're only in there for 4, maximum 8 years. So they need to appease this group and that group and make sure that they have a job and a comfortable lifestyle and what have you after their presidency is up. They have the these other nations that are influencing certain things. He owes money over here. He owes the Federal Reserve, and he better pander to Israel and da-da-da-da-da because the Jewish power elite, they control the republic. I mean, let's be honest. Who was whispering in Obama's ear for most of his presidency with, nothing but Rahm Emanuel? Just on and on. So that's what makes him – that is the key thing that makes him the true diplomat. The other thing about, being the true diplomat is that if he wants to go to war, he's either going to have to do it out of his own personal treasury or he's going to have to do it out of the nation's treasury. Of course, the nation's treasury technically is his, but there is a distinction. Should he – abdicate the throne, he still has his own, quote, personal treasury. Now, for him to dig into the nation's treasury, that's going to make people unhappy when he has to raise taxes or what have you. Also, again, we know exactly who's responsible. He can't just go around waging war on every bloody country in the Middle East and sending our men and women off to die for Israel on a whim, because everybody knows exactly what this guy looks like, what he sounds like, and guess what? We know where he lives. We know who is responsible. So this is the key thing that makes him the true diplomat. It is his power itself that makes him the diplomat.
Now, you mentioned a little bit ago about the money supply. So, John, under monarchy, who controls the money supply?
Okay, in monarchy, the monarch is going to control the money supply. And talking about gold and silver comes into this conversation. I want to bring it into this conversation because there's just a lot of this nonsense in the Patriot movement that people have a skewed idea of exactly what money is. They say, well, gold and silver, that's real money. All right, well, first of all, who controls the gold and silver? It's not the Republic, for the record, that controls the gold and silver, not right now. And is gold or any other precious metal or other material asset, is that money? No. Okay, money is just a receipt. That's all it is. It's, the reason why you use gold is because it's not easy to duplicate considering, nobody knows how to make gold out of thin air. Paper or paper money, people can make tons of that stuff, all they want. But it's just a receipt. That's it. So fiat currency is just as real as a receipt made out of something else. Well, why don't we use wooden? Well, let's make money out of birch. or let's make money out of cloth, or whatever the case is. That's just as tangible as it is being made out of gold. People need to stop this this gold obsession, which came from a particular people. It's pushed by a particular people. We won't name names. I think I named them enough. The real asset, the real financial asset that a nation has is its people. And I want to bring up Adolf Hitler here because it's important to cover this economic point. Now, if someone really wants to know the true history of World War II, what happened, who really – was Hitler really funded by the Rothschilds? Is he a Rothschild baby or is that just propaganda? It's propaganda. Was Hitler a white supremacist? Hitler never even used the word white to refer to the German people or the European people, blah, 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 blah. All these different interesting facts. I implore you to go and check out Veronica Clark. Go to Amazon and look up her book, Black Nazis. Oh, there were black Nazis? Yeah, there were black Gestapo, black German Abwehr, German intelligence, etc. Anyway, I don't want to be too long on this, but the point is, I'm going to bring up Hitler, and if somebody's kind of uncomfortable with that, well, I suggest you go and do your research, no offense. But Hitler's money, the Reichsmark, was backed by labor. But guess what? You know, isn't that really the asset of a nation? I mean, what makes a nation? Is it the dirt that you walk on? Is it the gold that you have in the ground? Is it the trees that you have? What really actually makes a nation and makes a wealthy nation? It's the people. We have labor in abundance here because we have plenty of people. Let's imagine that we do have a nation over here, relatively small, but they have tons of gold. They have trillions of dollars in gold. It's ridiculous. But their nation consists of five people. Are they really a wealthy nation? No, they're not, because all it's going to take you is, I don't know, a couple of AK-47s, maybe just a hand grenade should they get themselves positioned in a small room, and you now control all of their gold. So your nation is your people. That's your asset, and that is what you back your currency by. Fiat currency, there's actually no problem with fiat currency because it's just a receipt. That's all money is. What the problem is how much you print and who controls the printing presses. Okay. But wait, fiat. Let's cover that again. We need gold. If we have this real tangible thing, blah, blah, blah. Where is this gold going to be kept, by the way? And are you going to be able to prove how much gold we have? Nobody listening can prove that we actually have any gold in Fort Knox. It doesn't matter who becomes president or whether we say that we are, from henceforth, we are now backing all of our currency with gold or silver or whatever. You can't actually prove that. Matter of fact, you couldn't actually prove it if you went there unless you measured all the gold scientifically. Is this actual gold or is it fool's gold? Blah, 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 blah. You would have to measure every single ounce of gold, stacks and stacks and stacks. And that's just not going to happen. So it doesn't actually matter that you have the gold. It matters that you've convinced the people that your receipt has value. But guess what? How do you do that? You do it with a word. It's as simple as this. You reach out your hand and you say, "This has value." That's it. Now, some people take a little more convincing, so we'll say, okay, this has value and it's backed by gold, and then they feel comfortable. But we don't actually have any gold, and you can never prove that we don't. It's just a receipt, guys. That's all it is. It's a receipt for services rendered, for your labor. That's what money is. So the monarch controls the printing presses. The money, the value, the treasury is proportional to the labor force, is proportional to the amount of people and the skill sets and so forth that they have. Now, Hitler did this, and he turned around his economy overnight. night. We can do this if people wise up, or we can keep buying into this, you know, we need gold and gold, 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 and guess who controls the gold, and let's be stupid enough to get suckered into this money-changing game, and so on and so forth. I would rather go with Hitler's plan, economic plan of action, because it worked.
That's very intriguing, which you brought up, and definitely should be tackled on its own merit more in depth for a later broadcast. Now, you've been mentioning off and on about absolute monarchism. Now, from what I understand about monarchism in general, there are different schools of it, although probably not that many. I've heard a lot about constitutional monarchism. So, John, would it be accurate to say that constitutional monarchism is an oxymoron?
Yes, absolutely. Anything which is not absolute monarchy is quasi-monarchy. It is not monarchy. You know, constitutional monarchy is what they use before they get rid of you. This is how it works, and you can see this happen throughout history. They'll come in and they'll say, okay, let's put this constitution in here, then let's shove in this parliament, and then, you know, the king either abdicates or they just cut his head off in the case of the French Revolution. You know, so this is a step-by-step process that happens, and you can just go and review your history books, and you'll see this thing happen just over and over again. I mean, so, you know, we think, oh, the queen, she's evil. There's a lot of – there's people out there that are trying to get people to direct their attention towards the queen and claim that she is, you know, she is the pinnacle of evil. She's the one that's at the top of the, you know, this whole crime network that controls the world, et cetera, such as the documentary The Ring of Power makes that claim. Okay, but a parliament was installed under the British crown years ago. Okay, so this is not – what we're seeing here are the stages of the downfall of the British monarchy. It will only be retained so long as it serves the Zionist – let's not use Zionist. As long as it serves the Jewish agenda. Zionism only – it's only 2 centuries old or something. Less than that, century and a half maybe. These people have been a problem for a much longer time. Let's be honest. They serve – you know, so long as she is serving, the crown is serving the Jewish agenda, then her seat is fine and dandy. She's good on the throne and whomever else succeeds her. But if we look at the political climate that is, you know, in Britain today, and you can look at some shows on the BBC as well, they're constantly making stabs at the monarchy. You know, it's just sort of, oh, we don't need this. This is just old stuff. And, you know, let's just get rid of this. The monarchy, it costs us too much. Blah, blah, blah. There's no use, et cetera. You're seeing this spoken from the mouths of British folks, as well as seeing these things come up in shows, British shows. You know, there was a show on... I forget exactly what it was entitled, but there was a show on like knights, and there was a show on, you know, just some medieval history and some things like that. And it was interesting because the whole time they're like constantly making stabs at the nobility, you know, and oh, knights weren't what you thought they were. They aren't these great guys. They were just a bunch of bastards. And, you know, these kings, they were all just a bunch of scum and blah, blah, blah. So, anyway, I think it's time to take a break, and then we can get back to, you know, get back to the subject at hand.
Buddy, we're going to go to break for a couple of minutes. You're about to hear Burn Seven's song Tomahawk. So lay back, lie back, go grab a cup of coffee, whatever you need to do, and we will be back momentarily. All right, everybody. We are back with this 51st episode of the Last Bastille podcast. John, you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, so continuing on, are there any examples of monarchy in contemporary fiction?
Well, there's plenty of examples in contemporary fiction, and it's, you know, like, it's something that is a surefire win almost to, you know, to go back to those old days where we had monarchs, and people just love this kind of stuff. And this is why people love The Lord of the Rings, you know, because it's a story that really speaks to our hearts. It speaks to our spirit. It speaks to us as earthlings. You know, right now we have Game of Thrones, which, well, we can get into that. But, I mean, Game of Thrones on HBO, it's a series that takes place in a fantasy fiction world. And it's about the movements of, you know, the nobility, you know, their desires, their fears, their conspiracies and this, that, and the other thing. And it's really just focusing on what the nobles think and what they want to do and who they hate and this, that, and the other thing. Of course, you know, Lord of the Rings, like I mentioned, Narnia is about monarchy. And of course, there's a reason why Lord of the Rings and Narnia are about monarchy is because both of the authors, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, both of them were monarchists. And then, of course, we have, you'll see monarchy in children's fiction as well, such as The Lion King, you know. You know, C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite monarchist quotes comes from the mouth of C.S. Lewis, and he said, "Monarchy can be easily debunked, but watch the faces. Mark well the debunkers. These are the men whose taproot in Eden has been cut, whom no rumor of the polyphony, the dance, can reach, men to whom pebbles laid in a row are more beautiful than an arch. Yet even if they desire mere equality, they cannot reach it. Where men are forbidden to honor a king, they honor millionaires, athletes, or film stars instead. Even famous prostitutes or gangsters. For spiritual nature, like bodily nature, will be served. Deny it food, and it will gobble poison." And this goes back to what I was saying about your inner king, and that's what he's talking about here. You know, if you don't have that king or queen on the throne, if you don't have your princesses and princes and knights and so on and so forth, then people are going to honor these, you know, mere millionaires, athletes, prostitutes, film stars, gangsters, and so forth. You know, and all of these people pale in comparison to the nobility. So, yeah, there's plenty of things in fiction, but what you'll often see, and you know, just kind of, you know. Now that folks have listened to this and listened to my perspective on things, and maybe this might be the first time that they've really entertained this idea of monarchy for the United States or for their own particular country, wherever they may be, you know, just kind of keep an open ear to the things that you see in fiction. And you'll notice that they're really just always making these stabs at monarchy. I mean, and it happens almost as much as they constantly remind you about how evil Hitler was, or, you know, they come out with a movie about the Holocaust. I mean, there's been 150 movies or more about the Holocaust, as if we need to be reminded day in and day out. But anyway, you know, so just kind of pay attention to that, because they have to keep you thinking at the forefront that somehow their system of writing things on a piece of paper is going to be better.
You know, it's interesting you should mention that, John, because, like, as you mentioned earlier, you know, earlier this podcast, About the children. They don't want to grow up to become, you know, the senator, the congressman. They want to be, the princess, the king, or a knight, or whatever the case is. And it's kind of interesting if you were to draw, certain parallels as look at it as a few other things. Like, for example, in the Chronicles of Narnia, the four main children, they're known as King Peter the Magnificent, Queen Susan the Gentle, King Edmund the Just, Queen Lucy the Valiant, and then, of course, Prince Caspian, who later becomes King Caspian the Tenth of Narnia. Or you look at Lord of the Rings, guys, consider this. I mean, who's cooler, King Aragorn or Ron Paul?
Right.
Right, and then there's also even a little bit of other kinds of fiction. I finished reading recently Mark Twain's The Prince and the Pauper, which you can kind of view that one any which way you want, and it's actually a very good read, at least for expanding one's mind and at least attempting to get at the truth of the matter, however you're going to do that. But it very much showed, especially the pauper. It was very Tom Canty was the character's name. It was very interesting how John, you mentioned earlier about the inner king. It was interesting how in Twain's novel, Tom Canty, the pauper, Tom Canty's inner king came out, and he was able to successfully pass himself off as the prince as the prince for most of the book. So I find those different elements in literature very revealing.
Yeah, absolutely. And these people are just really attracted to this. And let's get an understanding by looking into Freemasonry. If you look at the titles of the degrees in Freemasonry, you see the Sublime Prince of Garbage and the Knight of whatever and so on. And it just, on and on, they have these terms that you would associate with the nobility. And there's a certain type of royal pageantry which goes on in Freemasonry. And I think that's a lot of, an attraction for the men that get involved in that fraternity. Is these are things that are, that come out of monarchy. However, Freemasonry being completely opposed to monarchy. And just for some simple evidence, I do want to mention this. Is Freemasonry's real agenda to take down monarchy? Because people think it's to create this new world order and this, that, and the other thing. Well, first of all, how are you going to create a new world order when you have monarchs standing in your way? Again, what monarch in his right mind is going to, United Nations, let him come in. I'll give him some authority over my kingdom. Why not? Monarch isn't going to do that. But a key thing to look at is the Freemasonic code, which is King Kill 33. Okay. Now, this is also a song by Marilyn Manson. And if you go to Google Images and type in Marilyn Manson, he would be the rock star, if you're not familiar. Type in Marilyn Manson and the word Freemason. And you will see that on his hand he wears the ring of Freemasonry. Okay? And of course he has its song King Kill 33. And this is really what it's about. That is what Freemasonry is here to do, is to take down monarchies, to create republics. So it may be uncomfortable for some people who are I'm anti-Illuminati, I'm anti-Freemasonry, and but I'm a Republican. Well, you just bought into a Freemasonic system. I'm a constitutionalist. Oh, okay, you just bought into hypnosis. This is Freemasonic hypnosis. Anyway, those elements are there, and I just think it's in our nature to be, as human beings, to be attracted to these things, to these monarchistic things.
So, John, just so that the listeners are crystal clear on this point, are you saying that Freemasonry's real agenda is to throw down monarchies?
Yeah, absolutely. That is its absolute, that is the secret quote unquote, of Freemasonry. Freemasonry serves the Jewish cabal, who were not tolerated time after Emperor Hadrian threw them out. King Nebuchadnezzar went to war with them. You know, on and on, the nobility have preached against them, have kicked them out, you know, and so on. So what do you do? Well, you send in your Freemasons. Your Freemasons, they're not Jewish. There's no reason to kick them out, right? They're just a bunch of nice guys. So that is, and Freemasons are the ones that let them in, you know. Well, the Freemasons, I mean, the Jews were expelled in 1492. People think, oh, well, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Okay, well, hold on a minute. The Queen of Spain expelled the Jews in 1492. That's the key reason why Columbus sailed the ocean blue, because Columbus's real name is Cristobal Colon. And Cristobal Colon was a Jew. So, you know, he sails the ocean blue in search of a new Jewish homeland, you know, because, you know, most of Europe had been expelling them by that time. They get expelled from one country or another every 20, 30 years. You know, they come here, set up shop. Well, first they slaughter, you know, Cristobal Colon, who wrote about in his diary how, you know, great it was, how easy it was to slaughter them and enslave their little girls, being the Native Americans. You know, slaughter these people and then set up shop, and, you know, then you've got Freemasonry. And the only thing that you're, you know, the central requirement of being a Freemason is that you believe in a supreme being. Oh, Jews believe in a supreme being. Let's go ahead and let them in our country, you know. And that's really where it is. They are the hand of the Jews, and the Jews, by and large, and certainly not every Jew, but by and large, the agenda of the Jewish power elite is to control the world, and to control the world through the monetary system and so on, which kings don't stand for, so Freemasons have to get rid of them.
Wow, that's I think those perspectives you just gave would obviously need to could obviously be very much gone into the weeds about for another broadcast at a later time, just because of the magnitude of that content. Something I did want to bring up, though, because it's just something I've been noticing from various people, were some very brief, like nonfiction or real life examples of monarchy in action. And, you know, one thing, of course, is notice, at least in the religious sense, how, you know, Jesus Christ has a lot of different titles attributed to him, but I think probably the most relevant one for the purposes of this particular episode is he is referred to as the King of Kings.
Right.
Also something else, you know, John, you brought up, you were basically alluding to the, I believe you were alluding earlier to the battles of Lexington and Concord on Patriots Day, which was, of course, April 19th of 1775. Something also, too, that our listeners have been looking into is, of course, close order drill as a specific training method. And, of course, in the historical sense, what happened at Valley Forge in terms of making at least the Continental Army better was, of course, the efforts of Baron von Steuben, who wrote the Revolutionary War Drill Manual. Now, what's interesting and what's not really said about von Steuben, which is why I want to mention it here considering the subject matter, is that Baron von Steuben, who was a Prussian, was actually involved in an effort to install an American monarch during the Revolutionary War period. Similarly, also roughly about that time, I think what's a little bit more commonly known is, of course, people wanted George Washington to be king. So while it is true there were certain anti-monarchical sentiments, such as Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which basically was just a big diatribe that says kings are bad for the most part, because there really wasn't much else in there for the most part. What is noticeable is that you have this other reaction from some of the colonists, as well as from other people like Baron von Steuben. And so there's this kind of interesting contest going on during the American Revolutionary War period, which I think is not really examined all that much. And you know, since we're kind of recommending books for people to look at, I would suggest that folks take a look at a book by William Moody entitled Monarchism in America. Again, that's William Moody, Monarchism in America. And this is actually a very good examination into certain efforts to install an American monarch during the Revolutionary War period, as well as various other things that were going on at that time that are not found in typical history books, and even a lot of alternative media content as well.
Right, you know, and William Moody, he was a naval officer, you know, United States of America, okay? And, you know, this guy, hugely, obviously, patriotic and so forth, and in his conception, the best way to ensure our liberties is through monarchy. And one of the first people that told me, and I had had this thought for a long time, because I was already comfortable with monarchy well before blatantly asserting myself as a monarchist, but a Marine told me when I talked about, well, you know, do we need to restore the Constitution? He said, no. Because what is restoring the Constitution going to do? You know, as soon as you do that, it'll, because of the technologies and the networks and the things that we have that are currently in place, or that the criminal cabal has in place and whatnot, it would be just that much easier for them to just overturn it once again. You know, I mean, this is a situation where you have, you know, electronic communication. You have people that are more interested in plugging into their television set rather than, you know, taking up arms against tyranny. But there's, you know, going back, there's something I really wanted to cover in terms of the democracy. You know, there's just a piece that I really want to get out there so people can understand the flaws of democracy, or a republic, which again is a democracy. You know, the politicians are elected once again by democratic process. And the politicians in almost all areas decide the direction of state by way of democratic process. So democracy, democracy, democracy. I don't care how many times you want to try to, you know, say that a republic is somehow different. So democracy is fundamentally flawed for two key reasons, among others. And I urge everyone to take a look at an article and Google this. The title of it is How Facts Backfire. Subtitle, researchers discover a surprising threat to democracy, our brains. Now, this was published in the Boston Globe on July 11th, 2010, and it mentions a study that was conducted by the University of Michigan in 2005 and 2006. The study shows that facts do not necessarily influence a person's opinion, and too often facts actually reinforce a person's flawed perception of reality. Now, in another article entitled "People Aren't Smart Enough for Democracy to Flourish, Scientists Say," quote unquote, the research of David Dunning, who is a psychologist at Cornell University, is reviewed. Now, Dunning's study shows that people who are incompetent are inherently unable to judge the competence of other people or the quality of their ideas. So a person can ignore these studies, which would then lend credence to the University of Michigan study, which is that facts actually strengthen misinformation for many people. But regardless, it doesn't take a scientific study to realize that if a person is not, for instance, a surgeon, they would be ill-equipped to pick out an honest physician, you know, an honest surgeon, rather, from a group of doctors who have been told to fool them. You know, so we imagine that we have these 10 physicians or 10 surgeons, what have you, in front of us, and I don't know anything about surgery. And if we said, okay, 9 of you are going to attempt to, you know, fool the audience, and the other one's just going to be completely honest about, you know, about medical practice, anatomy, blah, 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 blah. You know, am I or you, if you're not a surgeon, or going to be able to pick out the guy who's lying? No. You know, maybe on chance. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out. Okay, so why is it then that we tolerate the idea that the average person has the capability of picking out who will be the best leader for everyone else? Now, you and I and many of the listeners are pretty politically savvy, but we can be certain that everyone that's listening right now does not know a bunch of stuff about automobiles. You know, everyone that's listening right now is not a gearhead, is not a mechanic, okay? So let's go with this, okay? Would it make sense for you to randomly pick somebody from the audience who ends up knowing nothing about fixing cars and then have him judge a panel of mechanics? And then not only does he judge this panel of mechanics, with picking out the mechanic that's going to work on your brake system. Now, how is this person, being completely ill-equipped, going to judge whether he's picked out a master auto technician from a scam artist or just some backyard mechanic that doesn't really know his ass from his elbow? Okay. No one is going to do that. No one's going to say, well, you know what, I know absolutely nothing, but just go ahead and leave it up to me. You know, we're going to line up 10 and 20 of these guys that claim to be mechanics, and I'm going to pick out the one that's going to work on your brake system. That is a life and death situation there. He does the brake system wrong, you are dead. But we are supposed to believe that this democracy thing can work, that the average person has it in them to be able to pick out who the best leader is going to be for the nation. Now, outwardly, I agree that Ron Paul would be the best president for this thing called the Republic. That's outwardly, you know, keeping in mind that I am quite familiar with Ron Paul's Freemasonic connections, and I do not support the guy. And if anybody's interested in looking into that, then by all means do so. And for the record, I don't support a president, and I don't support a republic, so blah, 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 blah. But outwardly, I'll go with, we're going to go with Ron Paul. Okay. Now, I think that probably all the listeners can pretty much agree with me, even if they don't like Ron Paul. Hey, yeah, really, this guy sounds like the best guy out of the rest of these ridiculous, you know, guys we have lined up right now. How come he wasn't president? How come he wasn't elected president the first time he ran? Back in when was the first time he ran? That was back in was it the late 70s or early 80s?
Yeah, I'll have to double check real quick, but I think it was technically more during the 70s. But give me a moment to double check.
Right. So why is it taking so long? Because people are not equipped to be able, you know, to pick out who the best guy is. Well, how can we make them equipped? Okay. In a republic. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's review. How many different political positions are there? I mean, you've got city council, and you've got the judiciary, you've got the sheriff. You've got, you know, the congressmen and the senators and the this and the that and the whatever the case is, and the president himself. You've got these different issues that you need to vote on. You need to vote on these local issues, mayor, governor, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So in order for this thing to really work, we need to have the majority of those positions filled by honest people. And it's up to you and your neighbors to pick out those honest people, not just honest, but people that have good policies, good economic policies, good policies when it comes to foreign relations and so forth. In order for the average person to be able to do this, they are going to have to be well-versed in politics, economics, and so on. So I don't know about you, the listener, but were you born to politics? Maybe a lot of you were. because this is a political show and you are interested in this. But what about your neighbors? Is Joe Blow the, you know, carpenter that's, you know, he's just a basic run-of-the-mill kind of guy, whatever the case is, doesn't really give two flying this, that, and the other thing about what's going on CNN in the political arena? You want to give him the power to fight you, to pick who is going to lead you? You know, but we can ignore this stuff all we want, but then that goes back to the University of Michigan's study. You know, when you present the facts, and the facts are that people are ill-equipped, you know, you weren't born to politics. Maybe some of you were, but I would say that maybe most of the people out there, regardless of listeners or not, most of the people in the United States and abroad were not born to politics. They were born to be florists. They were born to be roofers. They were born to be engineers, doctors, teachers, priests, whatever they were born for. Why is it that we are supposed to put so much stock in a system that requires, that will require, that does require people to be politically savvy, thoroughly politically savvy, in order for this thing to work? It is the height of lunacy to think that democracy can work. It is completely, it is the antithesis of what we are about as a species. I mean, people look around and go, man, we need to wake these people up, et cetera, et cetera. You are admitting human nature. You are admitting the flaw of the very system that you wish to keep in power. How come they're not already awake? You know why? Because it's not their job to be awake. Democracy forces people to make it their job to be awake. And that is a denial of human nature. It is the height of lunacy to think that every voting person out there is going to know a bloody thing about who should be elected. Now, Francisco Crispi said that monarchy unites us, the republic would divide us. And this, what I've just said here, is exactly what he means, what he was talking about. And this is why I say that this we the people thing needs to be erased, and instead, just to make things crystal clear, they need to write divided we win, because it's a joke. It is a joke, people. Democracy pits you against your neighbor. Democracy requires that everyone is a political scholar, instead of monarchy, where you have one guy who's responsible, it's his job, and if he fails, my God, everybody knows exactly what this guy looks like, where he lives, and it's pretty darn obvious when he fails who's responsible. So thank you for that piece I wanted to interject.
Sure, of course. And for the benefit of the listeners, in terms of Ron Paul, he did run on the Libertarian Party ticket in 1988, second time in 2008, and then the third time is the current election cycle in 2012. But that first time was on the LP ticket in 1988. Okay, now moving forward. John, is it not true that republics inevitably degenerate into empires?
Yes, that is true. We can look at the French Revolution and then what happened. Napoleon comes along. Okay, not saying anything bad about Napoleon or whatever the case is, but Napoleon comes along. We can look at the republic preceding Hitler, and Hitler comes along. And this is something that you're going to see recurring as you examine, if you want to take the time to examine history, if that is what you were born for, what you're interested in, go ahead. Because it's going to fail because of things like Freemasonry, because of just the essence of how it was created. You know, we can get into debates and why that's a joke, and so on. But excuse me just for a few seconds. I will be right back. Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we will be going to another break for just a moment. So lie back, sit back, and we'll be back momentarily. Yes, okay, we are back, ladies and gentlemen. John, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry, I just had to step away.
That is perfectly okay. Continuing on, why is monarchy preferable to a republic?
Well, for the reasons I stated, but, you know, a republic allows criminals to get in. You know, it's deception is the name of the game. The guy who's more deceptive, the guy who's a better salesman, is going to be able to win, because this is just based off of, you know, this is just based off of public opinion. You know, who's the better entertainer? I mean, that's really the essence of it. And then that sort of, you know, gets into debate. I mean, look, when it comes down to picking our leaders in this republic, it is all based upon debate, and there's a problem with debate, and a monarch should never debate. I do not support debate because of this. Whoever is going to win, this thing is based off of things like who has the better suit, who is more physically attractive, who has the better voice. Who is a better speaker? I mean, we look at King George. The movie The King's Speech covered King George's stuttering problem. Okay? And we're talking here about King George VI, for the record. Now, he couldn't win a debate against a five-year-old when he had his stuttering problem. It's not until, and this doesn't mean that, you know, he wasn't fit for the job, but, I mean, let's look at this republic. In order to get a seat someplace, a seat of power, you can't be the guy that's, you know, in a wheelchair and obese, or the guy with the ridiculously funny ears who's cross-eyed. You can't be the guy that has the vicious stuttering problem, because this is all based off of public opinion. And these people aren't educated to make they can't make an educated decision on who the leader should be. So their decisions must be based off of something else. Now we, the listeners, the patriots who have studied this kind of thing, we can say, you know what? Ron Paul isn't like this super handsome guy. He's an old guy. You know, he's got that frail old man thing going on. He doesn't really project the type of power that maybe Mitt Romney does. But we know politics. We know what's good for us. So we can look at Ron Paul and, you know what? Out of the lineup here, Ron Paul is the best. And we can set aside the fact that maybe Ron Paul's suit isn't tailored as it should be, or he's kind of hunches over, or whatever other stuff one might observe. So with all the other reasons that I've stated why democracy, which is a republic, is a democracy, is bad, it won't work, etc., etc., one of the key reasons is because it's built upon the foundation of debate. The other thing is that it always leaves its doors open for criminals to enter. They're just wide open. Every few years, they're wide open. Let's just open them back up. So let's imagine, you know, once again, let's imagine that I believe and everybody believes that Ron Paul is the best candidate, regardless of whether we think so or not. He gets in there. Fantastic. He's in like Flynn, and he does his 4 years. you know what? He does another 4 years. Fantastic. Or maybe he passes away. You know, he's kind of old. He passes away somewhere in between there. Or, you know, whatever might happen. Some scandal or something. They pull out some propaganda nonsense and they kick him out, you know. Because, you know, after all, this nation is run by a bunch of criminals. They're under every rock and so forth. Who's going to replace him? Let's say he does make it to the 4 years, the 8 years, whatever. What's a good 8 years? I like that. A good 8 years of Ron Paul. That sounds great, doesn't it, folks? But again, the door is wide open. Now, would you rather have your neighbor, your neighbors, average Joe citizen, be the one to pick who is going to succeed Ron Paul, or would you rather have him pick his successor? I mean, really think about that. Who is most qualified? You know what? I am not qualified. I can admit this. To pick Ron Paul's successor. Because I don't know the ins and outs of Ron Paul's policies, his philosophy on life, his moral compass, this, that, and the other thing, as much as, guess what? As Ron Paul knows those things. I don't care how many books I've read. I don't care how many speeches I've listened to of Ron Paul. I don't know those things as well as he does. He is the most qualified person to pick his successor. So you have a situation in a republic where you're constantly opening your doors. And you're saying, oh, okay, all right, people, let's pick the next guy. And you think that your neighbors are qualified to make that decision? I mean, all it takes is a series of secret handshakes and this, that, and the other thing. Guess what? How many of your neighbors are Freemasons? You know, Freemasons are required. They are required to vote for a fellow Mason if that Mason is going to run for office. I've heard this directly from Freemasons, and there's a Freemason website talking about how Ron Paul, he sure looks to be a Freemason. I guess he is. Well, the Freemason says, who's writing at this website, I guess I must vote for him then. Okay? So, anyway, I mean, that really just sums it up. Your doors are constantly swinging wide open for, in you know, vermin, criminals, et cetera, to get in there. You've got the Jewish power elite and the Skull and Bones and the Freemasons and the Bilderbergs and everybody else who's going to be able to, oh, darn it. We had a good guy got in the seat that we wanted. Oh, well, guess what? Oh, we got to wait, my fellow criminals, is 4 more years, and then we can finally get, you know, Mr. Bush in there or whomever we want to, you know, get in there. It's just a joke.
Wow, I never quite thought of it that way before, where Ron Paul would actually choose his own successor. Actually, that's a very intriguing observation. And technically, you know, if – well, here's the one thing. I was just thinking about it just a second ago where, you know, which one sounds better, President Paul or King Paul?
King Paul?
Here's the thing, John. You know, if King Paul had the ability to choose his own successor, I'm just going to bet dollars to donuts that would most likely be, you know, his son, who's the senator, Rand Paul.
I'm just gonna
guess on that one.
And see, when you have that father-son thing, not only did Ron Paul raise his son, so he's instilled those values – he knows his son, and once Ron Paul passes away, who is most likely to follow in Ron Paul's footsteps? You know, they say follow in your father's footsteps for a reason, right? So, you know, and that's why you have, in monarchy, you have the children, you know, being the successors. But, of course, in absolute monarchy, in authentic monarchy, which is absolute, the monarch can choose anyone to be a successor, you know. So if you know, the let's imagine a monarch has three sons, and the first one, he's just a big drunk, and the second one, he's more interested in, you know, trying to be a rock star and skiing and whatever, and he's not really a politically minded kind of guy. The third one, he's the one to pick, okay? And the king is the one that's going to pick him. Let's go back to the Republic. In the Republic, the third son is going to have to debate. The third son is going to have to win over a majority of people. Now, we said that the third son is really the qualified one. This guy, you know, loves his father, loves his country, is going to follow in his father's footsteps. But there's a problem here because, things have just turned into democracy. And the third son, he's, well, let's just say not, let's just say he's not a looker. You know, a little bit awkward, you know, maybe kind of walks with a limp, no fault of his own. And his hands got cut off in some horrible situation because he went and served in the military and he got captured and he was a POW and they hacked off his hand and they stabbed out one of his eyeballs. Now, in your little democracy, in your republic, that guy doesn't stand a chance in hell. I don't care how great of a man he is. It's never going to happen. Because we're talking about a system that's created to appease a childish mindset, a mindset where people don't want to take an adult responsibility. They don't want to have the responsibility to say, you know what, I'm going to have to stand up and fight. If somebody takes my liberties away, I'm just going to have to do it. You know, they don't, no, not going to work. And, you know, versus a situation, monarchy, where it is a system that's created that exists for adults and men that have bravery. Harsh words, but that's what it is.
Wow, interesting analogy about the maturity of people being reflected in, or at least the system of governance that they live under being a reflection of their maturity. Now, just to be crystal clear on one point, you did mention it earlier, and I just wanted to double check on this. Are you telling us that debating as a method, as a technique, that debating is always unproductive?
It's not always unproductive. But I think that it is a very, very poor and extremely flawed means to pick out a leader. Debate is mostly entertainment, and that's what people enjoy about it. It's it's the campaign season, you know, and it's. You know, we can turn on the tell, oh, what's so-and-so going to say, and oh, what's his name said this, and, you know, whatever the case is. And I mean, if Ron Paul happens to pass gas on stage, I don't care if he's got, you know, 55% of the entire people, suddenly that's going to drop like a rock, you know. I mean, come on, this old geezer can't even control his bowels. He can't control this nation. Ha, ha, ha. And then you know how many of these nimrods, these numbskulls out here are going to – their opinions are going to be swayed by that? Or maybe the guy who is most appropriate for leadership, you know, a hair is out of place, his tie is crooked, or some other ridiculous nonsense. Debate is entertainment. You know, that's what – it's a TV show. This is what it is, you know. Where are the cheerleaders at? We need to put in cheerleaders into the presidential debates. Maybe that'll give people a bit better wake-up call about what they are witnessing. It is an immature system of election. It is an immature system of government, aspect of this government.
Wow. Yeah, and even my observations and those of other people would definitely support that, absolutely. You know, just as a quick add-on to that, there's always been a long-standing joke about you know, whoever is the candidate that has the best hair is the guy who gets the job. And it's sad because a lot of the time it's very, very true.
Right. Yeah, it's, I mean, gosh, there's so many different things. You know, if a guy mispronounces a word, you know, I mean, just on and on. It's just so flimsy. It's so bad. I think people need to really watch the King's Speech and ask themselves, you know, what does it mean to be a leader? Does it mean that you can speak clearly? Is that how trivial? How absolutely trivial. Does it mean that you're dressed well in a nice expensive suit? I think Christians need to ask themselves that question. Because, I don't know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Jesus wasn't, you know, walking around in Armani or Kenneth Cole or Donna Karen or whatever other suit. You know, so what is it? What are we really, really looking for in a leader?
I would assume that what would be good in a leader would be a ability to make decisions at the very least.
Indeed. You know, he needs to be smart enough to know when he doesn't know something and smart enough to be able to identify those that do know things that he does not. He needs to be able to, go, you know what? I'm not this great in this particular area, just like the president calls upon a general, because the president didn't necessarily spend his life studying warfare. You know, those are the kinds of things. That's the kind of leader that we need.
Now, as we begin to gradually wrap up for tonight, I think it's important to kind of shift towards how you would propose that things move forward. So I'd like to start off by first asking, how can these United States transition from what it is now to an absolutist monarchy?
Okay, well, plenty of the folks out there are going to be uncomfortable with these words, but you need a catalyzing event. If a revolution is to take place, you need a shift in consciousness, which requires a catalyzing event, quote, like a new Pearl Harbor. These people weren't dumb when they wrote those words. They knew exactly what it takes for a revolutionary change. And the revolutionary change, which came out of the mass murder of September 11th, 2001, which was planned, orchestrated by the Jewish power elite. And if anybody questions that, I highly suggest that you go to 911missinglinks.com and check out the two-hour documentary, which was put together by Michael Delaney and myself and has been seen by millions of people, recently translated into Spanish as well. What do we need for monarchy to take place? Well, I think things are going to have to get a lot worse, unfortunately. I don't want to make them worse. It would be nice if things were just peachy keen. But if we are really going to get out of this roller coaster, because a republic isn't all bad all of the time. But it sure is a roller coaster, isn't it? One minute we're in a war, the next minute we're not. One minute the economy's great, the next minute it isn't. One minute people are fine with their, you know, paying on their mortgages, and the next minute we got tons of people living on the streets. Okay, if we're going to get out of the situation, we need something to happen in terms of maybe the economy absolutely plummeting, flatlined, which would cause people to be adults once again. People have this sense of entitlement, which is what the illusion of a right gives them, what the Constitution gives them, this illusion that they're entitled to something. You are not entitled to anything. If you think that you are entitled to something, then you are not being, in my mind, an adult. we need to get rid of the sense of entitlement. Then we're going to fight. Then we can fight for, our liberty. Because people realize that they only had liberty when something bad, like a full-blown depression, happens. Then they will realize that they only had liberty. That liberty is the only thing that exists. There's no such thing as a right. We'll start the fight. We can make something happen. So that's, those are the key things. Beyond that, again, people organizing. But, if you're going to go up against Freemasonry, the Illuminati, et cetera, I mean, come on. These people have a very interesting sense of loyalty. Well, in fact, they have loyalty, and they listen to their leaders. They have hierarchy. And a lot of this stuff that's swimming around and poisoning the patriot community is these ridiculous concepts like democracy. We need to have a council, a republic, we need to have a new Congress. We need to have we need to get into anarchy or communitarianism, communism, or whatever. No. If you want a revolution to succeed, you need to have hierarchy. You need to have discipline. You need to have loyalty. You cannot fear death. This does not mean that the revolution will be violent, that will endorse violence or what have you. But it's a revolution. Come on. People are going to want to stop you. And that means potentially kill you or imprison you, etc. You need to face those facts. Need to man up. So why I would suggest that the real men that are out there, the cowboys, the real Americans, I suggest that they get together and they have some real tight bonds. They identify their leaders. They listen to their leaders. And they work harder than they've ever worked in their life to change things.
Wow, that is, I got to admit, at least in terms of explaining how courage works, I've been kind of noticing, certain people being cowardly in various respects. So even if they're not of the same political orientation, I think it's kind of fair to say that political dissidents of any orientation should really develop that courage and have balls to, basically go out and do what's right instead of. And our listeners do are familiar with keyboard commandos and stuff like that, but I think it's very good you're emphasizing the necessity for courage, just like the men on Lexington Green. All right, well, now what can for those people that do decide to become monarchists, John, what can American monarchists begin doing now in order to eventually manifest the monarchy?
Well, I would say, you make the connections and you educate yourself on monarchy. So you can be comfortable in your new choice, your new political position. And in terms of the monarchist party, revolutions take money. And as soon as you start asking for money, people start running the other direction, whatever the case is. But revolutions require money. So you can donate to the cause, what have you. We look at the American Revolution, the Revolutionary War, that cost in those days $25 million, which is a heck of a lot more today, of course. But making connections, beyond the monarchist party, beyond, putting your dollars at a specific political party. It's really educating yourself and speaking for monarchy and connecting with the people that actually do have courage. And stop wasting your time with people that don't have courage. Don't bother with debates. Don't debate anyone. I don't bother debating anyone on anything. I don't care. In monarchy, you just don't care. If you don't believe, it doesn't matter. That's the monarchist perspective. And that's, you know, that's really it, is just to spread the word, and the right people are going to listen. You know, you don't have to wake up everybody and this, you know, this nonsense. We got to wake more people up. You know, it's interesting. if you ask people, okay, well, how many people do we have to wake up? I mean, you know how many people every day turn the age of 18? How many people are born, you know, every minute of every day? You know, so let's actually, you know, challenge these people that say we need to wake people up, and you know, put a number on that. You know, exactly how many? Okay, well, let's say that we need to have 10 million people. Okay, fine. Then what are you going to do? Well, we're going to wear T-shirts and picket signs, and we're going to vote or something, you know, whatever. This whole system, this a lot of this pseudo-revolutionary nonsense sort of just panders to people's cowardice. You know, because it makes people feel like they're being a revolutionary by doing something which, in my mind, is not revolutionary at all, or is not effective. There may be some revolutionary aspects to it, but it's not really effective. You know, picket signs, you know, can work and things like that. But, you know, what's on your picket sign? Oh, you know, down with Obama. I mean, but that's ridiculous. How about this? How about put on your picket sign, the Jews did 9/11. Ah, now you're being effective. Okay. How about actually shaking things up? But you don't want to put on Jews did 9/11, because that might actually cause you to get punched in the face. Someone might actually come up to you and kick the crap out of you, or you start denying that the Holocaust ever happened. And that, you know how many guys have denied the Holocaust existed and ended up with their teeth kicked out of their skull? You know, start being a real revolutionary. Start telling the real truth, the whole truth, like Patricia McAllister, okay, who, you know, at this ridiculous pseudo-revolutionary, what was that whole thing, the 99%ers or what?
Oh, yeah, I think, yeah, John, I believe you're referring to Occupy Wall Street, and its subsidiaries, exactly. Which, of course, yeah. You know, which I have referred to other people as Occupy whatever, yeah. Because in each city the name changed. But, yes, yeah. They're this kind of weird commie whatever thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Prove it to yourself. Say something, do something that's going to get you to lose your job. You know, say the truth. The Jews control this country, okay? The Jews control this country. They control the Federal Reserve. They control Hollywood. They admit they control Hollywood. Go and type in Jews control Hollywood. You'll end up finding articles in the news written by Jews where they say they control Hollywood. You know, that's being a real revolutionary, not this keyboard commando nonsense, not putting on some T-shirt, Liberty Now, you know, don't tread on me, man. You know, no. Start speaking the truth. Yeah, that's being a revolutionary. So it's going to take, you know, for this thing to happen, is you need to have guys with balls, okay? Guys that are willing to get out there. Kurt Maynard, you know, Michael Delaney, you know, Patricia McAllister, Veronica Clark, you know, and maybe you can jot down these names, you know, later on and go and actually research some of these people that I'm talking about. Huey Long, you know, not a monarchist, but, you know, he paid with his life. Okay. You know, for the African Americans that might be listening, some folks to check out, you know, forget about this Martin Luther King garbage. He was nothing but a communist that worked for the Jews. Look up, you know, Malcolm X, Alex Haley's autobiography of Malcolm X. Malcolm X talks about exactly who is in control, and Malcolm X names the Jew. You know, look into Marcus Garvey, who said, "Look to Africa, for there a king will be crowned." You know, Marcus Garvey, the African nationalist, didn't say, "Look to Africa, for there a president will be crowded." You know, look at these people that actually put their lives and careers on the line. You know, not these, you know, nonsense garbage stuff like David Icke, who's, you know, appearing on all these different television shows and talking about reptiles and all this garbage. If somebody has something to say that is really the truth, their career will be ruined, their life will be threatened, et cetera, et cetera. You know, be a fucking cowboy. Excuse my language, but man up.
All right. Now, what happens after the monarchy is established?
Well, a lot of things would happen, but in these United States, well, first of all, you'd have to establish a monarchy either by violence, violent overthrow of the government, or by a lawful process, okay? And I'm for lawful process, not because I don't, you know, violence is always on the table for me, but I have no interest in killing my fellow Americans. I have no interest in a civil war. So that is the key reason why violence is off the table for the realization of a monarchy. Now, do I have any problem with executing certain criminals and so forth if we're talking about violence? No. Do I have any problem rounding certain criminal individuals up and so forth at gunpoint? No. Okay, but we're not getting into terrorism. That's not our thing. So the lawful process would be, you know, it has to be a democratic process, unfortunately. So all the flaws that we've been talking about with democracy, this foundation of marshmallows is where we need to begin to build the kingdom of the United States, which would be a very difficult thing to do. But if you're up to the challenge, then, you know, hey, contact me. I'm looking for people that are up to the challenge. But, you know, we would have to get a political party out there, and the Libertarian Party is now the third largest party, and they've had to spend millions of dollars. We don't need to come up with millions of dollars from the get-go. If we look at Adolf Hitler's revolution, how he was able to grow his party, he didn't have a bunch of money from the beginning, but backers, you know, saw his work, and it is a total myth, total propaganda that, you know, the Rothschilds funded him and so forth. Once again, if you're interested in that subject, please go to Amazon, check out the work of Veronica Clark. Anyway, once we can get off the ground just a little bit, then we can start attracting the folks that do have wealth, that do have some clout and so forth, and make some things happen. What would happen upon the success of the party, basically, we would seek to amend the Constitution, okay? You don't have to be the president or something to amend the Constitution. The president doesn't have the power to amend the Constitution to begin with, okay? But if you go to Google, you can type in, how to amend the Constitution, and there are two ways to amend the Constitution. And basically it comes down to this, is that basically we need a ton of people in the right places that say, hey, let's amend the Constitution. And then what that amendment would say is it would name a specific person, and it would say this person henceforth has the power to amend the Constitution or abandon it, etc. That person is then, from that point on, has the Constitution is the pinnacle of the foundation of this country. If he has control of the foundation of the country, he can just say, okay, whatever. Next amendment, I'm the king, and this Constitution doesn't mean anything. Boom, and then he's the king. So it can really just happen in that first amendment. That's all you really need to do is amend the Constitution. And I say that all you really need to do, but it is it's going to take some elbow grease. But that's how it would take place. You got to get rid of the Constitution. Other than that, what would happen is this country gets so rotten, and it's already just, you know, rotten to the core. With the Jewish power elite, they just control every aspect of this government. But if things get really bad, and that catalyzing event I talked about, where you have this just horrible, horrible depression or something like that, or let's say that they have a false flag, and it's just this time people are prepared for a false flag, you know, prepared in terms of, yeah, you guys did it kind of thing, not, you know, we're going to believe that Al-Qaeda did it nonsense. So people are sort of, you know, prepared if a nuke goes off or whatever happens, they're going to point the finger at the right people, which is, you know, the Jews and Freemasonry, just as, you know, 9/11missinglinks.com shows you. I mean, these guys were all over 9/11. It's absurd. And then you can have a situation, let's just imagine, you know, one particular situation would be Americans would just go, all right, we're tired of this. We're going to go ahead and point you as the leader. Let's make it happen. I'm following you. I mean, when I was entertaining, you know, being for Ron Paul many years ago, I had posed this to someone and I said, well, you know, what if Ron Paul said, you know what, forget about this whole debate, election garbage. You know what? This is the second American Revolution. Let's make it happen. Let's go to war. And I asked this person who was a veteran of many years and, you know, I said, well, you know, would you follow that? Would you follow his command? And he said, yeah, and he raised his hand as a salute and he says, you know, yes, sir. Boom. Okay. And that type of situation could happen. That's not the most ideal situation. There's a lot of bloodshed. If we look at Hitler's revolution, regardless, once again, of what people may think they know about Hitler or whatever, Hitler's revolution was virtually bloodless. They tried to kill him a couple of times. The communists and the Jews, Freemasons and so forth would go and rough up his guys in the street. But that was really it on the extent of the bloodshed. The communists made a grave mistake burning the Reichstag or the Reichstag fire, which Hitler did not do. If you want to, you know, again, if you want to research that, Alex Jones, of course, and the rest of his I Love Jews Zionist crowd will claim that Hitler was responsible for that, but that's just absolute and complete garbage. Anyway, so you have that catalyzing event that happens, and boom, next thing you know, he's in power. So there's some different ways that this kind of thing can take place, but regardless of any of these different things that we've talked about, all of it takes bravery and it takes elbow grease. You really have to step up to the plate and stop thinking that, you know, revolutionary action is in a t-shirt or, you know, writing a blog or whatever. You know, those things have their uses, but, you know, to be a true revolutionary is you putting your life on the line to change the system, putting your career on the line, having the bravery to say that, you know what, I may lose my wife and my children over fighting for my nation. You know, my wife may decide, you know what, I'm tired of you doing this stuff. You know, now you've lost your job for the things that you've said, for the truths that you've spoken, and we just can't take it anymore. And then she leaves with the kids. That's being a revolutionary. I mean, the revolutionaries of the Revolutionary War were walking in the snow with their shoes falling apart. And people think that, you know, the stuff that they're doing, making little comments on YouTube videos and making YouTube videos and stuff is revolutionary, is, you know, I'm a true revolutionary. No, not unless you're saying something that your career is being threatened. You get on there and start talking about how the Jews did 9/11 or, you know, whatever the case is, then we can talk. Anyway, I think I've said enough on that one.
Right, and obviously that could be expounded upon in a later broadcast. There was kind of a key question I did want to address before we close out for tonight, John. How should monarchists treat other political dissidents? And I think this is very key because anyone who studied really either the alternative media or anything that's counterculture, at least in these United States, understands that there's different ones. You've got your constitutionalists, which generally speaking is our audience here for the most part. There's also proprietarian anarchists, the anarchists who believe in private property, and various and many, many, many others. So I think it's very key to address how should monarchists treat other political dissidents?
Ignore them, essentially. You can attempt to educate them, but ultimately ignore them. I mostly ignore them. I don't have the time to debate people. I don't have the interest. And like I said, I've already, you know, talked about this, how debating is really just sort of entertainment. I'd rather have a small group of guys that believe in what I do. And not just guys, but, you know, ladies, gentlemen, et cetera, people that believe in what I do, then, argue back and forth about, what the best political system is, or, you know, whether Ron Paul's a Freemason or not, or blah, 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 blah. I don't need to, you know, I've spent many years, I've sacrificed my reputation, my career, just a lot of personal sacrifices, to arrive at this knowledge. I just don't have time for this kind of thing. I would suggest to the anarchists and the communists, and others out there, to go and look at who is behind these political systems, just as I suggested the Republicans and constitutionalists to go and read Viscount Leon de Ponson's work, Freemasonry and Judaism, The Secret Powers Behind Revolution. When you examine, for instance, the names of the people that are writing these books on anarchy, for instance. Oh, anarchy, it's so great. And you look at their names and you find that the vast majority of them are Jews. And then you look at socialism. We're not talking about national socialism, which is quite a different thing from Judeo-socialism, which is, you know, what typically people mean when they say socialism. We're talking about, you know, Chomsky's socialism or whatever. Well, who is Chomsky? He's a Jew. I follow objectivism. I think objectivism has some great things that we can employ. Well, who's Ayn Rand? Ayn Rand, she's a Jew. It's on and on and on. You look at, who are these people that are pushing these political systems? You're just not going to find too many Jews that are pushing monarchy. And there's a reason for that, as we've talked about. The monarchs, the dictators, the whatever, they don't tolerate Freemasonry. They don't tolerate Jews. You have a problem with Freemasonry? Well, fantastic. Better sign up for monarchy.
All right. Now, John, how can people get in contact with you? Are there any other links or anything else you'd like to throw out there?
You can go to there's monarchistparty.org, but that site isn't actually up. My email, you can go to my personal website, which I haven't really done much with because I'm sort of haven't really been doing the internet activism thing, been doing some other things. My personal website is johnmartinson2nd.com. So it's John Martinson and then the letter I twice, johnmartinsonii.com. And my email address is contact@johnmartinsonthesecond.com. So if you want to email me there, I'm open to a discussion, what have you. But what I found is that a lot of people will step up and say, yes, I'm ready for revolution, or I want to get involved, or something like that. And really, they aren't. So please, if you're a coward, just don't bother writing me. I'm not interested. I've had a lot of people, for instance, I was offering, I would train you in militia tactics or infantry tactics, what have you. And I had a lot of people that said, I want to come out. And, not a single one of them had the bravery to show up, which is a joke. I mean, you could go and look up your local militia and go and train with them. But anyway, the point is that there's just a lot of time wasters out there. When you talk about actually putting your real name out there, people run in the other direction. You notice that the people that I named off, those are all their real names. It's not only that they're going by their real names, but they're actually speaking the truth, and they've had huge sacrifices. They've made huge sacrifices. I don't waste my time with someone that's uncomfortable with giving me their real name. My real name, my information's out there. People know who I am, et cetera. But if you want to talk maybe what we can do, then I'm open. I'm always looking for more people that are actually willing to stand up and fight. I have two sons and, plenty of other loved ones, and I love my country and humanity and, and the things which are, in nature as well. And, this stuff is just being just decimated before us. We have a lot of horrible things that are coming down the pipeline, and we need men. We need real men that are going to stand up and actually do something and are going to be willing to fight and not this garbage, well, you know, we need to vote for the right person and sort of, you know, let's put on a T-shirt kind of thing, you know. We just need men that are willing to stand up and say the truth. You know, it wouldn't really take that many people to make something happen. You know, Hitler started with a very small amount of people, and it's by the time that he came into power, the NSDAP, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, had 1 million members. You know, we have over 300 million people in the United States, and you know, all we really need is a fraction of that, and other people are going to follow suit. They see guys standing up. They see guys with some, you know, they're going to follow the guys that have the balls, the bravery, the honesty, the people that really care about their country. That's who they're going to follow. And that's how we're going to make change.
Well, I would like to thank you, John, very much for coming on tonight. And while it is true that you and I do not see eye to eye on certain types of things, I must say that I admire your intellect. I admire your courage. And I admire that you basically address things that other folks simply refuse to, even those who claim to want to manifest a solution and claim to want to secure their liberties and the rest of it. And so I would like to thank you for that. And also, you know, I have been looking into monarchy as a serious option. I mean, you know, I've talked with several of my veteran buddies, and you know, we would talk about the Republic and that sort of thing. But then I would bring up about, you know, anarchy and monarchy. And what I always thought was interesting, John, was that virtually most of the time, they would say, oh, anarchy, I'm not considering that seriously at all. But monarchy? Okay, let's talk about it a little bit. And I just found that was fascinating. And since during the Revolutionary War period, there were certain monarchist tendencies, like I mentioned earlier, I figured it should bear investigation. And since you are an authority, a current authority on the subject, I did want to learn more about that from you. So I would like to thank you so much for gracing us with your presence this evening.
Right. You know, thank you very much for that. I did want to cover something because I did click over and I wasn't paying attention to the chat room. But I did notice that someone was saying something that I give a bad name to the militia movement. First of all, I'm not involved in the militia movement anymore. I found them to be mostly cowards and drunks and people that really have no concept of discipline. And they're really a joke. You know, if we look at Waco and then we look at Ruby Ridge, you know, the militia didn't do anything but come out with picket signs and T-shirts. The militia didn't do anything when 9/11 happened. I mean, most of the people in the United States know that the government there was a criminal thing that happened with 9/11 that had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. The militia still hasn't done anything. The militia will let your sons and daughters go walk off and, you know, get killed over there in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth and whatever. So I find that the militia to really just be a joke. In terms of as far as the Jews, if somebody wants to, you know, question me on, you know, oh, well, I think that the Jews are behind every single thing. Well, see, this is the issue with debate, is because someone can say a ridiculous comment like that. But I never said that. I never said that the Jews were behind everything. And this is how things can be skewed, because all that person is doing is just, you know, using a trick of conversation, of debate, to attempt to, you know, make me seem like, you know, maybe I'm a nutcase or whatever the case is. But, you know, the facts bear out. I mean, we can look at for instance, the NAACP, which was, you know, founded in 1908 by five Jews. This is openly admitted. You can do your research. And they didn't allow an African-American president of the organization for over 60 years. We can look at the American Nazi Party, which was active in the 1970s, which talked about how 6 million Jews were gassed and talked about white supremacy. Hitler never talked about white supremacy. He never even used the word white. And then we later find out that the leader of the American Nazi Party is a Jew. His name, he was going by, gosh, what was he going by? I can't remember now, but his real name is Joseph Cohen. Anyway, we can look at the transatlantic slave trade, and this is admitted by Jewish history books. Almost every single slave ship was owned by Jews. We can look at the expulsions of the Jews, which I've already talked about. They've been expelled from 84 countries a total of 109 times. We can look at the feminists. Almost every single major feminist leader is a Jew. Eve Ensler, Gloria Steinem, on and on. 50% of abortion clinics are owned by Jews. Almost every single major and minor gun control law was put forth by a Jew. Just go and look up Jewish gun grabbers. Go to Google, type in Jewish gun grabbers, and you can see that almost every single gun control law was put forth by a Jew. Okay, so these are facts. These are irrefutable facts. And I can go on and on and on, but are Jews behind everything that's out there? Absolutely not. Are there some Jews that have – matter of fact, there have been Jews that have spoken out against the Jews, against the Jewish power elite. For instance, Benjamin Friedman, he spent millions of dollars trying to teach people what I've been telling you tonight concerning the Jews. And you would think that he knows best, but, you know, maybe to some of these people that have never actually bothered to study this information, maybe that doesn't work for them. But you're welcome to go and research the attack on the USS Liberty. The Jewish State of Israel attacked the USS Liberty on June 8th, 1967. That was an NSA or National Security Agency ship. They killed 34 sailors, and they wounded over 170 others. This is a false flag operation intended to throw the blame onto Egypt and try to ignite a war between the United States and Egypt, because at the time the Jews were trying to take control of Egypt. And you can look at 9/11. Who owned the Twin Towers? His name was Larry Silverstein. What kind of name is that? It's a Jewish name. Obviously, we caught 5 Mossad agents on 9/11. You can go and look up the dancing Israelis. Why were there a bunch of dancing Jews celebrating that our police force, the New Jersey police, caught? I'm not making this up. Just go and research it. ICTS was the company in charge of airport security. They're an Israeli company. Odigo, which is an Israeli instant messaging company, received an early warning that day. Goldman Sachs also received an early warning. Of course, Goldman Sachs is a Jewish company. It's in the name. On and on and on. Almost the vast majority, I'll say, of the members of the Project for a New American Century, the ones responsible for saying that we need to have a new Pearl Harbor, almost every single one of them is a Jew. We can go on and on. I can go on about this stuff. But again, I don't debate. If somebody doesn't understand that it's the Jews, or they can't stomach that, or maybe they're afraid to say that or whatever, they're not the type of person that we're looking for. Henry Ford put his career on the line to produce the book called The International Jew. Yes, Henry Ford, the man behind Ford Motor Company. So if you don't have the balls to do that, then I just, that's just too bad for you. If you want to deny the obvious, deny that this thing has been happening throughout history, that, then that's just too bad for you. Don't waste my time. But thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you again, John, for giving us the time and your perspective on monarchy, just so for the furtherance of everyone's education. All right, everybody, that was John Allen Martinson, Jr. And if you folks have found this particular episode of the Last Bastille podcast or any of YHTOM's other broadcasts, either insightful or otherwise useful to you, please consider financially supporting us. You can do that by buying Colonel Joseph P. Martino's book, Resistance to Tyranny, from us by visiting youhavetreadonme.com/resistance_to_tyranny.html. Dr. Martino is a retired Air Force colonel. He served in Thailand, where he conducted research on counterinsurgency. He was later chairman of the Counterinsurgency Working Group of the Military Operations Research Society. He teaches a course in just war doctrine at Yorktown University. He also holds degrees in physics, electrical engineering, and mathematics. So this man is absurdly competent, and not just about this book's subject matter. Please keep in mind that we are independent media, as we are not funded by either the government or despotic corporate special interests. So, if you wish for us to keep the archives up online, as well as continuing to make more broadcasts, we do need to meet our monetary expenses, so please support us by buying a copy of Dr. Martino's book for approximately $18. This is a must-read for every militia unit, committee of safety, and frankly, every other political dissident who wishes to, what else, resist tyranny. For next week's episode on Saturday, May 5th, we will take a look at communism. I'm Sleepy Salsa, and thanks for listening.